Taking a trip down my true crime memory lane today, which might be a similar memorable case for you as well. But if you've never heard it, either way, let's dive into this most polarizing case from 1997. This is the murder of Matthew Eben. Sunil Eben was born in Chicago and attended the University of Illinois, a math and computer science major, but with dreams of becoming a doctor. And it was at the University of Chicago while he was studying medicine that he met his wife, Deborah, who was also a medical student. After the couple finished up their medical school training, they moved to Boston, and Sunil started his residency program there. They married in 1990, and 4 years later welcomed Brendan to their family, and then 2 years later in 1996, along came Matthew. And everyone in the family besides Brendan adopted shortened versions of their name and became known as Debbie, Sunny, and Maddie. Sunny was an anesthesiologist, and Debbie was an ophthalmologist. Now, because of Debbie and Sunny's busy schedule that often involved working long days, however, either Debbie or Sunny was usually home by 5:30, they used the services of au pairs, which are live-in nannies, but they're nannies that are kind of on a work exchange program from other countries. Au pair actually means in French, on equal terms. And many years ago, the term referred to young women from England that had traveled to France to teach English in exchange for learning French. But over time, the duties moved from teaching to more childcare and housekeeping. The housekeeping and the childcare part started in Switzerland, actually, where young single girls were moving in droves into the bigger cities to find work. And then there were concerns that this would loosen the morals of these young ladies, so they were encouraged to work in family environments. And then after World War II, au pair jobs exchanged between the UK, Switzerland, Austria, and Australia. They really just exploded in popularity, which made the US a large desired destination for cultural exchanges. And au pair placement agencies became kind of all the rage. Now, in order to work as an au pair in the U.S., you must be between 18 and 26 years old, unmarried with no children of your own, speak and write English fluently, and pay for your own travel expenses, and have 200 hours of documented infant child care experience. Now, these are the current qualifications. And back in the 1990s, au pair agencies offered a 3 to 4 day child care course that was required in order to join the agency. And in order to host an au pair, you have to have at least one child under the age of 18, provide them with their own bedroom and all their meals, and pocket money of at least $195.75 per week. And the hours cannot exceed 10 hours a day or 45 hours in a week, and you must be an English-speaking family. So in 1996, because the au pair arrangement can only last a maximum of 24 months, they hired their now fourth au pair shortly after Maddie's birth in November of 1996. Brendan was 2.5 years old at the time, and so Maddie was 8 or 9 months old, depending on what reporting you go with. Louise Woodward had joined the established au pair agency EF Education First Cultural Care Au Pair in June of 1996, after she had finished up her A-levels, which is the equivalent of graduating high school, at the age of 18, because she wanted to take a gap year before starting university and she wanted to travel. She had always loved kids. She had come from a very large family with lots of young nieces and nephews, which she often cared for. And she also really loved the intrigue of the U.S., so after completing the required 4-day training program that the agency required, she headed to Boston, where she was placed for 4 months with a different family on the outskirts of Boston. Louise interviewed with Debbie in November 1996 and then was offered the position. The EPINs required the maximum number of hours at 45 hours a week, and according to the EPINs, within a month or so, it was evident that there was a little bit of an issue. On more than one occasion, Louise was spoken to by the EPINs about her scheduling. Louise would sometimes come in after 1 a.m. and wasn't always up in time when they needed for them to leave for work. Like, they had to actually often knock on her door to get her up. Debbie in particular was concerned about this because she was worried that Louise's energy level and her patience would be affected by not getting enough sleep. In late January, Sunny had sat Louise down and told her that she basically needed to shape up or ship out. Now, this whole part of the story has been used as both a sign that Louise was a problem caregiver from the get-go, but also has been used to show that Sunny and Debbie were difficult and maybe overly demanding parents to work for. So to me, none of that kind of means anything as far as her being spoken to about her staying up late. She was 18 after all. However, at 3:45 in the afternoon of February 4th, 1997, Louise made a call to 911 from the Epen home.
911, you're gone. Sorry, what's your emergency?
Maddie Epen was taken to the Boston Children's Hospital. He was barely breathing and in really bad shape, and he was put on life support. The next morning, he was assessed by Dr. Eli Neuberger, who ordered a full set of plain x-rays. There was really no medical history available on Matthew because he was so young, but he did not appear to have any external injuries on their initial examination. However, the x-rays revealed there was some head trauma and a fractured wrist. Now, some say wrist, but others say it was actually on the forearm. The arm fracture wasn't as alarming as the other one. This one appeared to be old, as in like several weeks old, and showed signs of healing. A fractured forearm in a baby can often go undetected because babies don't use their arms and wrists like the way children and adults do to manipulate objects and move themselves around. But the 2.5-inch fracture on the back of little Maddie's skull was much more concerning. The other thing that the x-rays revealed was that at the time, there was kind of a triad of injuries that is indicative of shaken baby syndrome, which at the time was dubbed shaken impact injury. That's bleeding behind the eyes, bleeding on the brain, and brain swelling. So the hospital held this mini conference with Child Protective Services and reached out to Detective Bob Manning, letting him know that the injuries that Matthew Epen had were life-threatening and suspicious. Meanwhile, Sunny and Debbie were notified. They, of course, rushed to the hospital to be with Maddie. It was pretty clear to them and to the medical staff and detective that the injuries to Maddie were caused by the last person to have been in contact with him, and that would, of course, be Louise Woodward. According to a number of reportings, Louise made a statement to police that she had popped the baby on the bed, which in the UK means laid, but to police in the US kind of sounded bad. And one of the officers testified that she had said that she was rough with him and dropped him twice that day. But I don't think this seems very plausible, since Detective Bob Manning said that Louise had actually immediately contacted her supervisor with the au pair agency, and then they had quickly hired an attorney for her. She had been advised not to give any statement and to not talk with investigators or the detective, and was whisked away by the agency, which both worked for and against her. It looked suspicious, but it didn't provide any opportunity for her to give some kind of statement that might be misconstrued or lost in translation or something like that. Now, there is a reason why attorneys will always advise you to never say a word. You personally cannot be trusted to narrate your own story. it's kind of a thing. However, based on the conference of CPS with the medical staff, Louise Woodward was charged with assault and battery. Because after all, Louise was the last person in charge of Maddie's day-to-day care and the only person there at the time that the injury was sustained, which they estimated to be a maximum of 3 hours from the time that he had arrived at the hospital. Louise's parents, Gary and Susan, found out about her arrest by getting a call in the middle of the night to turn on the news. Gary caught the next flight out to support his daughter. Now, all of them and most of Elton, Cheshire, where she was from, felt that they were suddenly living this personal nightmare. On February 9th, 1997, little Maddie Epen, who had fallen into a coma, was taken off life support and died. So Louise's charge was upgraded to first-degree murder as having been a deliberate action of malice. Dr. Eli Neuberger, the doctor that had examined Maddie's x-rays, felt that Maddie had died as a result of being shaken forcefully and then slammed into a hard surface. It had been the sudden impact to his head that had shifted his brain, which created the brain bleed that led to his death. The pathologist that performed Matthew's autopsy was Dr. Gary Feagan. He said that the shaken baby syndrome was a bit of a misnomer in this case, but that it had definitely been intentional versus accidental head trauma that had caused the 2.5-inch skull fracture, and that the fracture was fresh, as in within 3 hours of the 911 call, and showed purple bruising, which indicated that it had not yet begun any attempts by the body to heal. Maddie's brain was swollen as a result of that. Now, Dr. Feagan felt that this was a very clear-cut case and that the only way it could have occurred was from blunt force trauma and that his normal functioning would have ceased at the moment of the injury, meaning he would have lost consciousness and not awoken. He would have been unresponsive, not a case of like progressively getting worse over the course of the day. The murder trial of Louise Woodward started 9 months after Maddie's death on the 6th of October, 1997, with Louise being brought into the courtroom wearing both ankle and wrist shackles in this girlish yet rather demure dress complete with white knee socks. Louise's au pair agency, EF Education First, had some fairly deep pockets and were motivated to exonerate Louise because a conviction for murder would, of course, definitely not look good for their agency. And they hired a rather exclusive and very expensive legal team, including Mary Scheck, co-founder of the Innocence Project, and of course of O.J. Simpson's Dream Team fame. Louise had been denied bail and was held at the Massachusetts Correctional Institution, which is a maximum security facility, while she had waited for her trial to start. Barry had filed to move the trial to a different jurisdiction due to the fear of a biased jury, because there had been a lot of media attention, but that motion was denied. The prosecutor, Jerry Leon, his theory was that Louise didn't really want to work and take care of the kids, but she more just kind of wanted to experience being in the U.S. and like a different life as a young woman. But the work to her had been secondary. The hours were long, often, of course, the maximum 45 hours a week that was allowed. She wasn't really motivated to be caring for two young kids, like really young kids. She presented herself as intelligent, polite, calm, and very demure, but also could be seen at times as being a little bit unemotional. And though the case was being really closely watched in the UK, whose, of course, their laws and procedures differed from the US, friends of Louise, who had grown up with her and, of course, her family, did not believe that Louise would have ever hurt a child, whether intentionally or by accident, and believed fiercely in her innocence, which of course polarized the media coverage, which was happening in droves outside of the courthouse walls. So because this case is so polarizing, we're going to go through both sides of the case, looking at the prosecution's case and then also the defense's. And we will do as they do in trials. We're going to start with the prosecution's case. Leon presented to the jury a total of 8 physicians, all of them were like neurosurgeons, pathologists, et cetera, including a child abuse expert who all said that the only explanation for Maddie's brain injury and skull fracture was that there had been a violent shaking and his head had impacted with a hard surface, which directly and immediately led to the bleeding in his brain.
A 2.5-inch skull fracture to the back of Maddie's head. A massively swollen brain pressing against the sides of his skull. Bloody retinal hemorrhaging in the area of his head between the eyes and the brain. These injuries were not caused by someone being a little rough. These injuries were not caused by a toss on the bed or a drop to the floor. These injuries weren't caused by a gentle revival shaking. These injuries were caused by a violent slam against a hard object causing that skull fracture, which eventually killed Matthew 5 days later. A violent slam against a hard object and severe full-on shaking. So that baby's head went back and forth, shearing the veins inside of his head, causing the retinal hemorrhaging. Actions that anyone would know would cause a little 8-month-old boy to die.
To explain the injuries that that I operated on directly, the subdural hematoma, the skull fracture, and the brain swelling, would have required a forcible hit of the head against some blunt surface. To explain the retinal hemorrhages, there would have to be an additional shaking or swinging of the head in some fashion.
That the magnitude of the findings on the CT indicate that the injury must have been imposed within minutes to a few hours of that CT scan.
She said that he was cranky and that he was crying and he was fussy.
And did she tell you about the bath?
She did.
What did she indicate occurred prior to the bath?
She said that she carried the child into the bedroom area.
By the child, you mean Matthew?
Sorry, Matthew. And by her own words, she tossed him on the bed.
And did you ask her to demonstrate for you what she meant by tossed?
I did.
And what did she do and say at that point?
She said, tossed, you know, tossed, and with her hand, she made a forward movement as if tossing something.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Now, did she indicate for you what she did after she tossed Matthew on the bed?
She said that she went into the bathroom area to draw the bath and that she laid a towel on the floor.
Now, did she indicate at that point, after she laid the towel on the floor, what she did with regard to Matthew?
She said that she returned and got Matthew and brought him into the bathroom area. She told me that she dropped him on the towel, which was on the floor.
Did you ask her to demonstrate for you how she dropped Matthew on the towel that was on the floor?
I did.
And what did she do and say at that point in response to your question?
She said, I dropped him. I dropped him. And again, with her hands, she made a movement.
Now, after she indicated to you that she had tossed Matthew on the bed and dropped him on the floor, did you ask her any questions about her demeanor that day?
Yes, sir, I did.
Did she respond to you?
Yes, sir.
What did she say?
In response to my question, were you angry or mad? She said that she was angry and she was frustrated and just crying.
Did she say why she was angry and frustrated?
She told me that he was crying and cranky all day. She told me that she may have been a little rough with him, or she was rough with him. I distinctly remember her saying the part that she was rough with the child, or she may have been rough with the child.
Now, during the first month, She began November 18th, right? During the first month, how many evenings was she home with you?
During the first month, despite the fact that she wanted to be part of a family, she only stayed home one night.
As December approached, specifically mid-December, were you having any problems with Louise Woodward concerning her child care habits?
The problems that started coming out within the first month were that she just could not be ready in the morning. She was not up on time. She wasn't ready to take the kids. She started having later and later nights. Mid-December, one night she stayed out till 1:30 that I knew of, and I was very concerned. And that same week, she was late in the morning at least three times. The main problems that we had were her late nights, her inability to be ready in the morning, and leaving the children unattended and doing personal things when she should be taking care of the children.
And can you describe the discussion as it took place with the defendant at that time?
Yes. Before we even got into any of the specifics, I said, you know, before we waste time on each thing, either you're staying or you're going. You know, we have to work this out one way or the other because we can't keep going on like this.
Did she respond to that?
She seemed nervous and concerned that we were going to fire her. One of the emergency room physicians said that they had an ophthalmologist look at his eyes and that it looked like there was bleeding in his eyes, and I knew what that meant, and I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it unless I saw it, and I asked if I could take a quick look while they were arranging the CAT scan.
If I could direct your attention to the week of January 19th through the 25th. Were you still having these problems with the defendant concerning late nights and inability to get up in the morning?
That's correct.
And can you describe what happened for the ladies and gentlemen of the jury when you came home at 5 o'clock that day?
Sure. I came home, and when I opened the door, I found Brendan was in our family room, which is immediately on the left as we walk in. He was watching TV, and I didn't see Matthew and Louise. I just presumed they had gone upstairs to change his diaper or something. And I continued on after I spoke to Brendan for a little while and asked him how his day was. Went back into the kitchen, and I found Matthew in the dining room lying alone. In the meantime, I heard some noise downstairs in the basement, so I just hung out there until about 5 minutes exactly by the clock was done, and I wanted to wait longer, but I was just getting more and more angry, and I yelled downstairs for her to come up.
And at that time, did you have a discussion with her?
I did. I said, I was really angry, and I said I found this behavior to be completely unacceptable, that she just cannot leave the kids alone for any period of time like that, and that she was down there for a long time. And when she came upstairs, she looked me right in the eye and said that, you know, she just went downstairs, less than a minute. And right then she said, you know, she told me that she was very upset and that she can't talk about it right now, that she was going to start crying. And I said, you know, it's okay to cry. That would be okay. But she said, I can't talk about it right now. And I said, all right. So she went back downstairs for a little while and came back up. And I said, do you want to talk about this now? And she says, well, I have someplace to go. I said, Louise, this is really important. I mean, is there something you're not understanding about what's going on here? And she said, you know, I was only down there for a minute, and you're really blowing this way out of proportion, and I feel like you're yelling at me about this. And I said, this is really important. This is the essence of why you're here, is to keep the kids safe. Basically, she had to agree to all of these statements, which she did, and that was a contingency as to what she was going to be staying with.
Now, in his opening statement, Leon claimed that the impact injury had been so severe that it was the equivalent of being thrown from a two-story building. But over the course of the trial, he kind of relented on that a little bit. But the fact that he had put it in his opening statement did light a little seed about the jury in the jury's mind about Louise's possible actions. Now, on the 911 call, Louise told the dispatcher that she thought Maddie had choked, so she was told to turn him over onto his stomach. But when the paramedics had arrived, he was still face up. Now, Louise had said that she was trying to do whatever she could to save him, but had not listened to the 911 operator's instructions. The main points of the prosecution's case was that this triad of symptoms, the brain bleeding, the brain swelling, and the bleeding behind the eyes, unequivocally meant that this was a case of shaken baby syndrome, and that Louise appeared unemotional and somewhat immature about the situation. They also presented testimony that au pairs are given very little training, and lastly, that Louise Woodward was the last and only person with Maddie Epen when the injury was sustained, which they again said was a maximum of 3 hours before she had called 911. As for the defense, they had a number of refuting claims, but two of the big things that they did was block any application that the jury could choose between first and second degree or manslaughter, and instead they could only choose between either first degree, second degree, or an acquittal. Their theory being that a jury would not find that she had the intent for it to have been murder and would instead vote to acquit her. However, some legal experts theorized that this was actually because the defense team, who again had been bought and paid for by EF Education, that au pair agency that Louise had been working for, that they were actually trying to avoid a civil lawsuit over their training processes and their screening process. If Maddie's death had been premeditated, they could not be held liable. But if not, then they could be sued and a financial judgment could be made against them. The defense countered the prosecution's case that Debbie Epen had been initially impressed with Louise at the interview stage. Maddie did not present with any external injuries. There was no bruises on any other part of his body other than the skull injury. Now, this was particularly important to their case because the level and the extent of the shaking that the prosecution had said had happened would have left marks from being gripped, and there would be injuries to his neck. And the autopsy report didn't mention any shaking, just the note that his head had struck something.
The government has just told you that on February 4th of this year, Louise Woodward slammed Matthew Epen's head down on a hard surface, and that you'll hear their witnesses claim that this force, this slamming, was the equivalent of dropping this baby on his head from a height of 15 feet from a second-story window onto concrete. Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence in this case will show that that did not happen. Their witnesses will also tell you, as Mr. Leone has mentioned, that they claim that Louise Woodward took Matthew Epen and shook him for a full minute. Shook him. That, ladies and gentlemen, is less than 10 seconds. The evidence in this case is going to show you that that never happened.
That amount of shaking and the impact would have taken a great amount of strength and endurance from somebody as well, which maybe wasn't likely in Louise's case. The defense was able to bring in Dr. Husinki that testified that even mild impacts can cause bleeding on the brain and that the neurological effects can be delayed. Like the injury will continue to bleed, or like a seizure or another injury can then set the symptoms off and then they go kind of downhill from there.
Doctor, have you reviewed the autopsy findings?
Yes.
Have you reviewed the pictures at autopsy?
Yes.
Have you reviewed the medical records in this case?
Yes.
Have you reviewed the x-rays?
Yes.
All right. Doctor, what is your opinion? Do you have an opinion, I guess, again, to a reasonable degree of scientific and medical certainty? Based on the records you've reviewed and your expertise and your review of other cases, as to whether or not Matthew Epen on the morning or afternoon of February 4th was shaken back and forth violently for about a minute with his head snapping back and forth. Do you have an opinion?
I do.
And what is your opinion?
That didn't happen.
One essential part of shaking, if shaking is in place, is damage to the neck. Unless you have damage to the cervical system, you cannot produce the effects on the brain.
Were there such injuries in this case?
There were no injuries in this case.
Dr. Jean, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty as to whether Matthew Eapen was shaken violently on February 4th with his neck snapping back and forth uncontrollably?
Yes, I have an opinion.
And what is that opinion? Please tell the jury.
That did not happen.
In this autopsy of this child, do you see anything that you've just described that you ordinarily see when you have severe shaking?
I see no evidence of neck injury at all.
Of the kind you were describing?
Correct.
In my experience, looking at skull fractures on a daily basis, they have scalp soft tissue swelling when they're new. When they're old, the scalp soft tissue swelling can go away. But a new skull fracture declares itself on the CT images with evidence of scalp soft tissue swelling.
Now, even in terms of orders of magnitude of impact, okay, is there, in your opinion, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, any basis for believing that this bone window, Exhibit 38, could be in the form that it is now if this child had been slammed against a fixed hard surface with the velocity of impact approaching a drop from 15 feet onto a fixed hard surface?
Absolutely not.
Matthew Eapen did not suffer a violent impact to the head, and certainly not on February 4th.
So beforehand, they could be sleepy or grumpy before actually losing consciousness. Dr. Yusinki said that this did not appear actually to be a fresh injury and could have occurred up to 2 days before, when Louise was actually on her weekend break, kind of implying that either Sonny or Debbie could have been responsible for a more mild injury. Now, I will say that Louise's trial was the first trial to have been televised in the UK. And so part of the polarization over the case was some opinions that, particularly Debbie, being a working mother, she was a bit villainized in the media as being selfish and coming off as detached. Her testimony had been seen as unemotional as well. That a lot of people felt that they were just demanding employers. Now, originally the defense was not going to have Louise testify on her own behalf, but she really wanted to. She wanted to tell her story and maintain her innocence. So they wound up allowing it, and unfortunately she came off as unemotional and quite immature. She also had a really bad habit of nervous kind of laughter or giggling that did not help her at all.
Ms. Woodward, did you ever shake Matthew Eapen violently?
No.
Did you ever hit Matthew?
No.
Did you ever slam Matthew about the head?
No.
Did you ever slam him at all?
No.
Did you do anything to hurt Matthew Eapen?
Never. We did a lot of make-believe. We danced to music. He liked to sing. He sang a lot. Brendan liked to read too. And we used to read with Matthew. Matthew would look at the pictures, and we did all sorts of things. And Matthew was really a placid baby, so he'd laugh along if we were being active. If we were dancing, I used to hold him and dance with. And with Brendan, he was chewing some toys. And I was emptying the dishwasher, and I was talking to him, and just trying to get the house tidy for when Sunil came home. And the basement door was always kept open. It's in the kitchen, so to let the heat rise. And I could hear that the washing machine had stopped. So I wanted to go downstairs and put the laundry from the washing machine into the dryer. So. I went and did that.
Okay, and did you do anything else while you were in the basement other than just move the wash from the washer to the dryer?
No.
And when you completed doing that, what did you do?
I came back upstairs.
And when you did, what occurred?
I saw Sunil standing there. and he was very unhappy that that I had left Matthew to go downstairs. I said I was only down there a minute. I only changed the laundry over. So we had. I was getting upset because he was mad, and I said to him, "I'm really confused as to what my duties are. I don't know when I should do the things that you want me to do, and I've been told different things by both parents. So I didn't know what I was supposed to do and when I was supposed to do it. I suggested that we have at a meeting that he would write down for me his expectations of me, what he wanted me to do. I put a toy into his crib that he liked. It was a musical caterpillar that you pull out and it played You Are My Sunshine. And I put that on him and I went into the bathroom.
And was he lying on his stomach or on his back when you did that?
He was on his back.
And you said you went in to wash your hands. And what happened next?
He stopped crying when I put him in the crib. So I went back and I looked into the crib and he was unresponsive. He was lying there. His eyes were half closed. He wasn't focusing. He was gasping for breath. He was kind of like this, and he looked kind of off color. So he didn't look right.
When you say off color, can you tell us what you mean?
Kind of blue, kind of bluish.
And was there anything else about him that you said that he didn't look right?
Well, his eyes were half closed, and that he wasn't looking at me. That he was just staring up.
And so what was your response on seeing him like that?
I was very frightened. I panicked. And I picked him up out of the crib, and when I did, he vomited on me. Or something came out of his mouth.
After he vomited, what did you do?
I thought that he had choked, so I lay him down on the floor and I put my finger inside his mouth. We'd been through CPR, Debbie and Sunil and I, because they told me in case anything happened to the kids, if they choked, what I should do. So I felt inside his mouth and I couldn't, there was nothing there. So I tilted his head back and I tried to give him CPR. I tried to breathe for him. I lay him on the bed, and I started screaming his name, and I was clapping around his head, and I was trying to see if he could see me, and I was waving my hand in front of his face. He didn't respond. He wasn't responsive at all. He didn't do anything. So I took him, I picked him up, and I went downstairs with him, and I lay him down on the dining room floor, and I went to the phone and I tried to page Sonny.
Did Sergeant Byrne say anything to you when you first saw him?
He said that they'd come to get information for the doctors, and he wanted me, would I be willing to talk about the day with him? I said, of course. He read me my Miranda rights. He said that he wasn't arresting me. It was, you know, just a precaution. It was that he always did that. He liked to read the rights to people.
Now, during the course of that conversation, were there a lot of questions about what took place while you were getting Matthew ready to take a bath?
Yeah, Ben kind of focused in on that. Went to the bathroom and he got a teddy bear. Well, I think Dan went out and got a teddy bear. They brought it back. And they wanted me to show how he put the teddy bear down on the bathroom floor.
And
sorry, how he put Matthew down on the bathroom floor, but using the teddy bear.
And did you demonstrate that with the teddy bear?
Yeah, I did that for him.
Now, at any time during that interview, did you tell these police officers that you had tossed Matthew Eben onto the bed?
No.
Did you tell them that you dropped Matthew on the floor?
No.
Now, did the phrase being rough with him come up?
Yes.
And what do you now remember about the phrase of being rough with Matthew during that interview?
Well, the officers were talking, and I think Apocrypha said he had a nephew, and that he knew how frustrating it would be to hear a baby crying constantly. He knew that that must be very frustrating for me to have to hear that. And Downing agreed with him. They said to me, so maybe you were just a little rough with him. You know, it must have been frustrating for you. Maybe you were a little rough. And I said, well, maybe I wasn't as gentle with him as I could have been, because I was trying to get the bath over with fairly quickly because he was tired. So I told him that maybe I wasn't as gentle with him as I could have been. And what I meant was that I was being kind of quicker than usual.
Okay. Now, did you ever say that or agree with them when they used this phrase that you may have been a little rough with them?
I guess I agreed with them. I mean, I didn't mean that, but...
And were you actually rough with Matthew?
I don't think so.
Were you asked specifically whether Matthew struck his head?
Yes.
And what did you tell him?
I told him I didn't think he had. I don't think so. Ben said, but it's possible, isn't it, that he may have when you put him in the bath, maybe. I said maybe, but I don't think so. I was pretty sure about that.
So just to sum up here, Ms. Woodward, did you ever hit Matthew Eapen?
No.
Did you see Matthew Eapen's head become injured?
No.
And did you slam Matthew Eapen?
No.
And did you do anything to hurt Matthew Eapen?
No, I didn't.
I have no further questions.
And you never said that you tossed Maddie on the bed. Never said that.
No, I said I popped him on the bed.
Popped him on the bed?
That's just an English word. It means I popped him onto the bed.
You told us on Thursday that you laid him on the bed. Did you pop him on the bed? Did you lay him on the bed? Or did you toss him on the bed?
Popped and laid are the same thing.
They are?
To me, yes.
What word did you use to the Newton police?
I think I said I popped him on the bed.
Oh, so that's why they might have thought you said toss. Pop sounds kind of like toss, huh?
I don't know. That's what I just tell you, that's what I told them.
When they asked you if you dropped them on the floor, did you say you popped them on the floor?
I don't know.
That might have been a reason why they thought you said dropped if you said popped, huh? Because that sounds similar, right?
I don't know what they would have thought.
But in any event, you never said you dropped...
I never said I dropped him. And I didn't show him that I dropped him.
I'm sorry?
I didn't show Sergeant Byrne that I dropped Matthew.
I didn't ask you that, but I'll ask you that now. So you never demonstrated to Sergeant Byrne how you dropped Matthew?
I demonstrated how I put the baby down on the floor.
And when you demonstrated that for him, did you tell him this is how I popped the baby down on the floor?
I don't know what words I used. I demonstrated and my fingers were touching the floor. I demonstrated like I did.
Well, I saw that on Thursday, but the word you used on Thursday was I told the Newton police that I laid the baby on the futon and I laid the baby on the floor. Did you or did you not use those words?
I don't know what words I used. It means the same thing to me.
But it could have been popped instead of laid.
It could have been. That's a word I use.
What about bang? When you had a conversation about banging the head on the floor. Do you remember that part of the conversation?
Sergeant Byrne asked me, could he have hit his head? He said, it's possible, isn't it?
And when Sergeant Byrne said, is it possible whether he could have hit his head? Your response was, he may have banged his head when I dropped him to the floor, wasn't it?
No.
What did you say in response to Sergeant Byrne at that
time? I said, it's possible, but I don't think so.
When you went to check on him at 12:30, you were worried about him at that time, weren't you?
after I found him in the crib at 12:30, that worried me.
Yeah, you're worried about him.
I was worried that he wasn't eating enough.
Well, you hadn't heard from him. That was unusual to you, so you were worried. So you went to check on him.
Yes. I just went to see, you know, what happened to him, why he hadn't called me.
Had you shaken him at all before that time that day?
No.
And when you clapped and you called and you ran around with Matthew Weeping upstairs, that's because you wanted him to be okay, right?
I was trying to get him to respond to me.
That's because you realized what you had done at that point. Isn't that true, ma'am?
No, it's not. I didn't know what was wrong with him.
Matthew was rushed to the hospital on your watch and due to your 911 call, right?
Yes.
And there was no one else upstairs in that house at 33 Beamoth Road who knows what happened besides yourself and Maddie Eapen, right?
Yes.
And the last time Maddie looked at you before becoming totally unresponsive, looked scared and shocked, didn't he?
No, that's not what I said.
I have nothing for her.
This is a woman who has told you and anyone else who would listen and not distort what she had to say. The truth. The whole truth. Nothing but the truth. This is not a murderer. This is not a child killer. This is a child lover. You saw that come through when she testified. She can't help it. The love of children comes right out. This is an innocent person.
She's trying to do this bad. She's got a slippery, wet, fussy, cranky Maddie Eapen. You think she's happy now? Maddie keeps crying, and she can't stand it. And as Maddie keeps crying, what does she do? She takes Maddie out. Okay, bath's over. And she told you, she cut the bath short. Bath's over because she can't stand the crying and fussing. What does she do? Takes him out, puts him in his little Mickey Mouse suit. And what's happening? Maddie Eapen is still crying. He's fussy, he's cranky, and she can't stand it. So she grabs Maddie Eapen, and she shakes him, because it worked earlier. Stop crying. Maddie Eapen doesn't stop crying. You know why? He's 8 months old, and he doesn't know that a shake means stop crying. So she shakes him a little more, and Maddie Eapen keeps crying, he keeps fussing, and she keeps shaking, but it ain't working. And Maddie Eapen is still crying and fussing until she now takes him and she slams his head down. Maddie Eapen's not crying anymore. Now what happens? Remember the half-truths, half-lies? What does she tell you she does? She puts him in the crib. Oh, what did I do? What did I do? Now she starts thinking about it. She's upstairs. Brendan's downstairs in front of the video. Maddie's in the crib. His little brain's starting to swell against his skull. What does she do now? What does she tell you she does? Comes back to the crib. What does she see? Half-truths, half-lies. He's unresponsive. She picks him up. Bet she picks him up. Maddie, wake up. Maddie, wake up. His eyes roll back in his head, and his head rolls back. Now she knows she's in trouble. Now she knows she's done it. What does she do then? Does she go to the parents' room and use a phone? No. Because she can't tell anybody what she's done. Of course she can't. Could anybody say what they did to that little boy? No. So she stalls, and she claps, and she waves, Maddie, wake up. Because she knows what she's just done. She screams, and she does everything she can upstairs. But Maddie Eaton's not waking up. And I just ask you to do one thing, ladies and gentlemen. Assess the aspiring little actress over there, and whether or not she told you the truth when she said she did absolutely nothing to Maddie Eapen on February 4th to cause his injuries.
There was also a mention of the retained damaged brain tissue that had been saved from Maddie's autopsy that was lost. And therefore, the defense never had an opportunity to have their own experts test the samples for their own findings. And there was also never an opportunity for them to have an independent autopsy done on Maddie because he was interned after the state autopsy was completed. And this completely outraged some legal experts in the UK that they do not actually intern bodies until the trial is concluded for this exact reason. Now, before the trial, back in May, Louise had undergone a polygraph examination by an examiner that had been hired by her lawyers. And because it was done by the defense, they could have admitted it as evidence, but they decided not to. And I believe it was because although she had passed the test to a 95% certainty, and it had been reviewed by another examiner to be accurate, both experts had been hired by the defense. And because of the majority of the questions were worded in a way that was like, did you deliberately blah, 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 instead of leaving the questions more open to any kind of actions that Louise might have taken that could have led to Maddie's death that were not intentional. Throughout the course of the trial, which was one of the most watched in court TV's history, the public remained really divided. Not so much over her guilt and responsibility, but that first degree they felt was a bit of a stretch, and that Maddie's parents actually bore some responsibility for being too busy to care for their own children and had hired inexperienced nannies. But just as many people saw Louise as irresponsible and cruel and a big fat liar, the fact that she was maintaining that she'd done nothing wrong and was oblivious to what must have been very obvious injuries and a very intentional act. And on October 30th, 1997, after 26 hours or 3 days of deliberations, the jury found her guilty of second-degree murder. Now, the trial had been presided over by Judge Zobel, and based on the jury's conviction, he sentenced her to life in prison with a minimum of 15 years to be served.
If you take a baby and you shake it and you slam its head, and I think it's reasonable to say that Louise Woodward, who grew up taking care of kids, who came to the States to take care of kids, who was trained doing it, who was told by her former au pair host family not to shake their baby, she knew that when she did this to Matthew Epen, she was likely to cause his death. That's all the jury had to find. They were rightly instructed, and I suggest they rightly found that verdict. To speculate now whether they would have chosen manslaughter, I think, is a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking by the defense counsel.
And she's paying the price, and it just outrages me that that OJ is walking the streets and Louise has been had her life basically taken away by the court system.
And in a move that I think is probably pretty routine but not usually successful, the defense immediately filed for a post-conviction hearing to have the jury's conviction overturned by the judge. Before the instructions had been given to the jury, four of the members of the jury were moved to alternates. And of these four, they were all ones that the defense felt were leaning towards an acquittal. And after polling the jury, which is something that both the prosecution and the defense have the right to do, they discovered that the jury had been split regarding the murder versus acquittal, but that the ones that were leaning towards the acquittal had been persuaded to go with a conviction. But nobody on the jury believed that Louise had murdered Maddie. And on November 10th, a hearing was held, and in a very historical decision, Judge Zobel reduced the conviction to involuntary manslaughter, stating that, quote, the circumstances in which the defendant acted were characterized by confusion, inexperience, frustration, immaturity, and some anger, but not malice in the legal sense supporting a conviction for second-degree murder. I am morally certain that allowing this defendant on this evidence to remain convicted of second-degree murder would be a miscarriage of justice. And so she was actually released that day on time served, which was a total of 279 days, which was much to even Louise's surprise that expected at that point that she would serve at least 10 years. And this change was upheld by the Supreme Court of Massachusetts and was a final decision. Sonny and Debbie were livid and believed wholeheartedly that Louise Woodward had murdered their son. On June 16th, 1998, Louise Woodward returned to Elton, Cheshire. Sonny and Debbie filed a civil lawsuit to prevent Louise from making any money off of her side of the story. Now, it was a suit that Louise had lost just by default because EF Education was not named in the suit, so they were no longer covering any of her legal expenses, so she couldn't afford to put on any kind of defense for it. Now, she did hold a press conference maintaining her innocence. She did do an interview with BBC, which she was not paid for. Sonny and Debbie still maintain that Maddie was murdered in malice. They have gone on to have three more children and still mourn for the loss of little Maddie. Louise entered the London South Bank University to study law and graduated with honors in 2002. And in 2004, she started with Ainley Halloway, which is a law firm in Old Hand, Manchester, but quit actually to pursue a career as a ballroom and Latin dance instructor. She is married. She had a daughter in 2014. Dr. Patrick Barnes, who was the radiologist from Stanford that had testified for the prosecution, he actually changed his mind about the case in 2011, saying that there had actually been research done into head injuries since then. Quote, "We started realizing that there was a number of medical conditions that can affect a baby's brain and look like the findings that we used to attribute to shaken baby syndrome or child abuse, such as infections and in utero strokes." Dr. Ellie Neuberger, who was one of Matthew's treating physicians and convinced that Louise had caused Maddie's injuries, believing in the science of the triad of injuries, which is 100% indicative of child abuse, died in 2024. And that was the case for and against Louise Woodward in the death of Matthew Epen. I am interested to know what you think, to, you know, discuss amongst yourselves. For me personally, I think obviously she did something that caused his injuries. I don't know that it was necessarily intentional. I think, she might have, maybe he fell and hit his head, or she may have gotten a little rough with him, but I don't think that she actually did the actual shaking and then slamming his head down. But I think she did cause the injuries that led to his death. I think she panicked. And now, of course, all these years later, she can't really admit to it, because it's to have someone's brain have that kind of bleed after such a long period of time. I think would be really unusual. And although I totally believe that there are a number of medical conditions that can lead to the same symptoms, I don't think that that's what happened in this case, but that is just my opinion. I think she deserved some prison time, probably not a life sentence. She was very young at the time. I think she probably should have served about 10 years and then been returned to the UK. But again, nobody asked me, so that's how it went down. Anyways, in the meantime, before next week when I have another episode come out, you can do your rate review thing. There is merchandise available on Spreadshop. All you have to do is go on there, spreadshop.com, and search a million other choices. There's a bunch of designs there. You can pick your design and then whatever you want to have it put on. The prices, I think, are in US, and I don't set the prices, so I'm hoping they're not overpriced. But whatever, it doesn't matter. If you want them, buy them. If you don't buy them. It's fine. You can also sign up for ad-free and bonus episodes on redcircle.com. Again, by searching a million other choices. And the same thing with Patreon. You have an option on Patreon. You can either just do ad-free, or you can do ad-free and the bonus episodes. The bonus episodes, I will tell you, they are full-length episodes. I usually put on there ones that are maybe a little controversial or maybe just a little bit more graphic than the regular feed if you're into that kind of thing. And again, I'll be back next week. As always, thank you so much for listening.